You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. I'm back here in the Gangland Wire studio. I have on the phone a lot of you guys from Chicago will recognize this name, the Shark, Joe Lopez. Joe, welcome.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hope everybody's doing good during this crisis and staying safe and staying secure, and hope that all of the families are doing well.
I do too, and I know it's been a pain, but what I've been doing, Joe, I've been recording extra podcasts and putting them out. It's the least I can do, put a little extra entertainment out. So,
hey, the show must go on, Gary. You know,
yeah, it must. You know that too. You know a little
sure
bit about
I do.
Show business, don't you?
I got a stamp card, of course.
I heard that.
Interesting. So, Joe, you're a pretty well-known criminal lawyer up there in Chicago. I got on to you from the Chicago Outfit Facebook sites. You're always commenting on there and stirring people up, or telling them how things really happened, rather than the myths and rumors that often get propagated on in the different social media platforms. Let's go back and see where you came from. Now, you're an original Chicago citizen, is that correct?
Born here on this concrete.
That's what I thought. So where'd you go to high school, Joe?
I went to high school in the suburbs at Addison Trail. In my neighborhood, they tore everything down to build U of I, so everybody scattered.
Interesting. Where'd you end up going to law school?
I went to law school at Chicago Kent, which is part of IIT, Illinois Institute of Technology.
What were some of your early, did you go right into criminal law?
You know, it's funny. I did not, Gary. When I was young in law school, I worked for a lawyer, and he had a corner office, and he had a Porsche, and he partied on Rush Street all the time, and he was a divorce lawyer, and I wanted to be a divorce lawyer. That was my goal in law school was to become a divorce lawyer with a corner office and my own Porsche. But it didn't turn out that way, because what happened was, and I kind of wanted to stay away from all of this because I'd been around it my entire life, and I wanted to go kind of in a different direction, you understand?
Yep.
And I didn't really want to do it. I had friends who were doing it, and you know, they wanted me to come aboard, and they wanted me to do it because I could speak Spanish. And at that time, we had the Cali cartel had just come to town, and there were Colombians everywhere. There were Mexicans, the Herreras were everywhere, and there was all kinds of drugs coming into the city. It was a cocaine explosion. This was 1983-84, a long time ago. And what happened was my first year of practicing law, I remember I opened my office. I gave a guy an IBM Selectric typewriter my dad gave me as my first month rent, and I started my divorce practice. I had a couple of clients that he gave to me, the other attorney did, and I started on this divorce venture. And then all of a sudden, we had the Gaylord investigation came to town.
Yeah.
It was exposed that all these lawyers were going to get indicted, and all these grand jury subpoenas went out. Somebody says to me, can you take this case in the federal building, to Kelo, the preliminary hearing case, the Colombian woman? I guess I can handle it. I mean, I've seen enough trials at the Daly Center and at 26th Street and the federal building while I was in law school. So I figured I could handle this hearing. And I worked hard on my questions, and I spent time on it. And I went to the federal building, and I had a finding of no probable cause.
Oh, wow.
And I went back to the office and told the attorney, and he had a look of amazement on
him. I bet.
And then I thought, you know what, when I was in law school, I had Judge Warren Wolfson, very well-known professor and judge here in Chicago. His brother, Dean Wolfson, actually went to jail in the Gaylord investigation. Dean Wolfson was my trial advocacy teacher. And I remember that we did this trial. It was a criminal case. And it had something to do with a brain injury. And I remember it was a mock trial. But I had a real witness. I had a real doctor. And the other side had a real doctor. We put a lot of time into this case. We presented it to a mock jury,
mm-hmm.
and it was a hung jury. The professor said that had never happened in the history of anybody teaching this class. So, in the guy that I tried against, it became my best man at my last wedding, and He became a big personal injury, very successful lawyer in Chicago. Eventually, he had a little issue. He went to federal prison for a while, for a year. He came out. He got his law license back. Now he's living in Nevada. But he never forgave me for that because he was an ex-Chicago Sting soccer player, and I had gone to UIC with him. When I came back from this hearing, I thought to myself, you know, that should have been a signal way back then to go into criminal law because you got a little knack for it.
Yeah.
Because I've done things that weren't supposed to happen. I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just saying what happened. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. From that point on, I got another case from another well-known lawyer who was indicted. He wanted me to represent his son in the federal building. I got sworn into the federal building, and I was in front of the grand jury within 3 weeks on a case. I got subpoenaed to the grand jury, and at that time, that's when I had just met a lawyer by the name of Lou Carbonaro. And Lou was a very famous Chicago lawyer in the outfit circles. He represented many, many guys. He was Angelo LaPietra's lawyer and many others. We met each other on a murder case that I had, and he had the co-defendant, he had Mario Rinone's brother, Louis Rinone, and it was a murder. Mm-hmm. I asked Lou, can you help me out? Lou brought me in there. We took the Fifth Amendment, and everything went away. But, you know, it was 1985. It was scary, and then I kind of started, you know, getting into it, and then, you know, I got a couple of guys that I knew over in Bridgeport and Taylor Street. Can you do this? Help me in this, and, you know, do that, and Lou was giving me a little bit of stuff, and you know, and I started getting clients that were accused of being an organized crime, as well as all of my colleague cartel guys. I mean, they used to call me the in-house counsel for the colleague cartel over here.
Oh, boy.
I had a lot of them. And that's kind of like how I got into the business. It was kind of like I kind of like stumbled into it, you know, without any clear game plan, so to speak. It wasn't what I thought I was going to wind up doing. But, you know, one thing I've learned during this COVID crisis is that I'm never going to stop.
Yeah.
I miss it. I really miss it.
Bad. Your court's been shut down?
On Zoom, we have hearings, but, you know, it's hard to argue from your dining room table to a screen.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It loses all the flavor, but, you know, eventually we're going to be back. But I've been doing this since 1984, so I've got a lot of years in. And I've been practicing in federal buildings since 1985, so I got a lot of years in there. Back in the 80s, I used to travel a lot, the 80s and especially the early 90s. When NAFTA opened up the border for Mexico, all mm-hmm. the coke started coming through the border because the coke used to come up the eastern seaboard mostly. It really didn't come up through Mexico at the time. Some boats would run from Veracruz to New Orleans and Tampico, and they might have a little bit of smuggling. But really, when NAFTA happened, what happened was the Colombians went into partnership with the Mexicans. And this is kind of like on Narcos. This is kind of a backstory on Narcos for you Narco fans out there.
Yeah.
They used to call Guadalajara the trampoline. And they called it the trampoline because the coke would land there and bounce right out of there because the Colombians went into business with the Mexicans. We'll bring the dope to you. You bring it to the United States. So that's kind of like how the transition went of Colombians being mostly suppliers as opposed to traffickers. I mean, they still traffic up the eastern seaboard. They still traffic out in Europe. There's no question about that. But the majority of the stuff came through the borders in trucks. I mean, we're not talking about people with backpacks running over a wall. That's a small deal. You know, these guys are organized. They got tunnels. They got planes. They got cars. They got, you know, they got all kinds of stuff. So back in the 90s, I mean, I flew from coast to coast and border to border. I've been to some really weird places, some really small places, and I've been in places where people looked at me like I was an alien because I had a ponytail and a black Armani suit and pointy shoes on and a gold Rolex and the whole nine yards. I mean, I looked like out of central casting for Miami Vice back in the day when I had my ponytail and everything.
Really?
And we can talk about that later. We'll talk about Sam Carlisi and that ponytail later on in the podcast because of Sam, I had to cut it off. And we can talk about that later.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the backstory that I have. And I've done a lot of, you know, a lot of drug cases, and I've done a lot of murder cases, and I've done a lot of outfit cases. So I've been doing it a long time. I enjoy doing it. I try to help people as much as I can. I feel that my job really is to get people back home to their families. It's more important sometimes to get somebody out home than anything else because, you know, being locked up in jail is a bad thing. And, you know, there's a lot of good people that do bad things and they have good families that want him to come home. And, you know, sometimes I feel like you know, my job is just to get to minimize the blow so they can get back to their houses and get back to their families.
Yeah.
It's important. It's important that it happened. And that's how I kind of like see myself in the system, is trying to get people home. I want to get people home and win cases. But first, yeah, I want to get them home. It's more important to get them home than it is to win sometimes.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Here's what I've seen a lot of, especially in that federal system, and things that a guy like you can do. The guy may be dead wrong, and there may be all kinds of evidence, but they'll overcharge him. They'll layer those charges on like crazy, and you know, you got to have a good lawyer that'll sit there and start knocking those other charges up. Otherwise, you'll be in with these draconian sentences over the last 20 years since the 80s. Why, the guy be in jail forever over, you know, really wasn't that big a deal what he was doing, but they make it look like it was. And then a guy like you can start knocking off all those extra charges and get down to one charge that you can make some kind of a decent deal over.
Yeah, and you know, the problem with the federal building is you know, it's got a 98% or 99% win rate.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of times you go in there and you're forced to plead guilty and you gotta mitigate the crap out of it. You know, my wife does very good over there. I mean, she had a guy with 7 kilos, got 30 months. I mean, no cooperation, no snitching. That was the last case, and you know, sometimes we get in these cases. We just had one not too long ago where it was a big sentence, but we cut 80 months off the sentence. I mean, 80 months is a long time.
That is.
And you know, that's kind of how it is. You know, like we tell people sometimes with the federal system, is it's kind of like cancer. You can beat it, you know, in the beginning. You might be able to motion it and beat a little bit of it, but in the end, it winds up taking you. It's unfortunate. I always tell clients this, you know, the federal system is so heartless that they put Martha Stewart in jail and she makes cookies.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know about the federal system.
I'll tell you what, I used to work a lot of cases with the FBI and DEA too, and especially FBI. I used to look at these, watch these guys and help them surveil them and you know, get informants that know a little bit here and a little bit there. And I used to think, you know, if they only knew the weight of what's coming down on them, I mean, there'll be, you know, like 50 detectives and agents working on one guy and the periphery things, and they, it's like they have no idea the weight of what's going to come down on them with unlimited budget, unlimited resources, and you know, but they'll do it anyhow.
And you're right, it is unlimited.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is truly amazing the power that the federal government has when they take out after somebody. It's just it's terrifying, really, if you think about it. Just hope it's always used for the correct purposes.
Well, the last thing that I saw that happened to the DEA when it came to money was when we had the budget crisis, remember?
Yeah.
I had agents tell me they couldn't get by money. I thought that was kind of funny.
Really? That is funny.
Have you run into this? We work with all these different agencies, and guys would start picking targets because of the things that they had. They wanted to seize their car, or if they had some kind of fancy car or an extra big house with a swimming pool or something, and they would start choosing targets to go after because of the things that they had so that they could get through civil forfeiture. Do you run into much of that?
They fork it all the time.
Yeah.
I'm so used to it. I mean, I can remember I testified in front of the Illinois Senate subcommittee many, many years ago on forfeiture, and I was actually on a committee that helped rewrite the old forfeiture from the 80s to post 89 or 90. And you learn that a lot of these municipalities, I mean, this money that comes out of these seizures gets shared with many different agencies. And there's an incentive for them to seize. I mean, the Supreme Court stopped it not too long ago, but back in the day, it was awful.
Yeah, it was.
You'd be on an airplane something with money, and they would take it from you, even no matter who you were.
I've seen them take houses from people that you know, had a family and everything living there, and you know, they just take the house. So the family was totally out. It was there was a lot of overreach with that. I'd heard that they'd pulled back quite a little bit on that. So you know, and you're right about you came in this business at the right time. That explosion of cocaine coming up from south of the border, this I-35 that comes up from Laredo straight north to Kansas City and on north. That was a cocaine highway one way and the money highway the other way.
Well, you know, yeah. It goes all the way to Honduras.
Oh yeah, it does, doesn't it?
35 was the main smugglers. That just controlled the whole thing.
Yeah.
Back in the day, that was all Zeta Highway. And yeah, Zeta's paid off everybody in Texas too. I mean, they owned 35; that was their highway, and it became a big thing. There was even a Netflix Mexican story about it called Route 35.
Really? I didn't know that.
It's about two cocaine, sort of like The Sopranos, two cocaine families that mix up together. It's in Spanish, and you know, it's a Caracol production. It's about $1 million they spend on every production. I mean, it's really well done, and it's about snitching, because Rule 35, Route 35, you get Rule 35 is to reduce your sentence for snitching, plus you got Route 35, which is your smuggling route. So that's what the name of the show is kind of patterned after.
It's Route 35 on Netflix, you say?
It is.
Interesting.
Folks, you'll have to look that one up. I'm going to. I love those things about the like Narcos, and there's one 000 out there. The thing about narcotics, it lends itself to organization. It makes for a much more interesting story. It, you know, you've got all these different division of labor and different people involved, and have to put these parts together. I love those stories like that.
We can talk about one of those stories and organized crime whenever you're ready. I can tell you one.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so back in the late 80s, there was a guy by the name of Victor Plesha I represented. Victor Plesha, Frank Bonavolante, Camillo Grossi, I forgot the other defendant, four of them. Well, what they were doing in the late 80s is they were taking, they were all part of what they alleged to be the Cicero crew back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they alleged that they were taking the gambling proceeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Driving to Miami, filling up the trunk, and coming back. And they did that for a number of years before they got caught. And they actually got caught on a gambling wire that kind of like popped up. Where, you know, back then they said, the outfit guys don't do drugs. They don't touch drugs. Well, not only were they selling drugs, they were doing drugs. We could hear them snorting cocaine on the wire.
Yeah.
So they indicted Victor. They indicted Frank Bonavolante. They indicted the Grossi, and you know, it was an organized crime case with the cocaine attached to it. But one of the things that I really liked about Victor was is his American Express at the Fountain Blue for like 3 days was like $15,000.
Oh my God.
So they were having fun in Florida.
Yeah,
they were making a lot of money. They were having fun in Florida. They were bringing the stuff back up here. The allegations were it was going, you know, all the money was going all the way to the top, and everybody was not paying attention to where it was coming from. You know,
yeah.
So that was kind of like everybody, we're not into it, but they're into it. But that case, it was an interesting case. It went to trial. The case actually went to trial because nobody ever really pleads guilty. And during the trial, I remember that my client, Victor Plesha, there was an informant that wasn't called, so we couldn't get into how dirty he was. And I think they paid him $40,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting case because it was a double jury. It was one of the first times in the federal building that we had a double jury. And I can't remember the year of it. I remember I had my blue Corvette, and it was a 1988. So it was somewhere between 88 and 90.
So by double jury, explain that double jury thing. I'm not familiar with that.
We had two juries, and I can't remember. We raised some kind of conflict where we tried to sever the case, and the judge said, I'll just give you two juries. So I think Grossi had his own jury, and we had our own jury. So we had.
Oh, I see. For different defendants, so you can present all your evidence at the same time, but then for one defendant to have one jury, another defendant to have the other jury. Interesting.
That's correct, and that is correct. And I remember, we were set up in the court. We had one jury in one jury box, and then we had the other jury. I'm trying to remember how it was configured. It was in Judge Norgel's courtroom. I know that we were in the center, but it was really the first time they ever did a double jury in federal court. It was a very unique thing at the time to have this occur like this. But we had this double jury, and I remember our table, the jury was behind us. So during my closing argument, I guess Victor, and I didn't see this because I was doing my closing argument, held up a sign to the juror that said the informant is this and that, and he got paid this and that. And so I'm doing my closing argument, and I'm not really paying attention. All of a sudden, the judge halts the proceedings. What's that sign? What's that sign?
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. And everybody looks at Victor. He's got the sign in his hand, right?
Yeah.
But let me see that sign. And I'm back, it said whatever. U.S. attorney's going crazy. Absolutely bonkers. Just having a fit about it. I'm trying not to laugh, right? And act serious. Because I think it's great. I think it was funny. You know, he got sick. You know, he was tired of it. So that's how he responded.
Yeah.
And I remember the judge telling me, Mr. Lopez, I'm going to find your client in contempt, and I want you to file a rule to show cause against your client. And I looked at him. I says, Judge, I'm not filing anything.
What? I don't think you can do that ethically.
I'm not the prosecutor. I'm not filing anything. I'm not doing anything against my client, and you can't order me to do so.
He goes,
he was screaming. Steam was coming out of his ears, and I think finally the prosecutor says, Judge, I think we have to do it. But they remember, that was the highlight of the trial. They were found guilty. Victor was given 25 years in that case just for having a gun and cocaine. It was ridiculous. Ridiculous. A ridiculous time. Just absolutely ridiculous. And, well, Victor was kind of violent. They brought in all this stuff at sentencing about how he smashed an ashtray over some guy's head in the restaurant. You know, he just liked to fight. He was a tough guy. He was a good guy, though. He's a really good guy. I really liked him. And Frankie Bonavolante, he was a super, super dude. In fact, the funny thing about that is I broke my foot in the middle of the trial in one of my construction projects. I fell on a construction project. So I had this giant cast on my leg. And, of course, I'm known for pink, so I made him make it pink. But I used to get a ride either from Kevin Bolger, and everybody knew this. Either Kevin Bolger would pick me up, who represented Grossi, or Frank Bonavolante would pick me up and drive me to the courthouse every day. So I got to know Frankie a lot. He was a real gentleman. Every time someone would cut him off, he would not beep his horn. He wouldn't. And this guy was a vicious character. Mm-hmm. He looked like a good guy, you know, nice. But he, deep down inside, he was vicious like Victor. But God, you know, when it came to dealing with the public, he didn't exhibit any sign whatsoever. This man was, he was as humble could be. He was just a humbling guy, a really good guy. He actually died inside the joint. It was really a shame.
Interesting. That's an interesting case.
It's funny because one of the things that happened during that case is we happened to be in the restaurant the same night. They did these tapes they had some intercepts over at Bertucci's Corner. He's over on 24th by Union over there. I was actually in there that night when the Victor and all the informants, and I knew Victor. We were sitting at a different table. It was like a different group of people. And I remember all the people sitting there and talking. And I remember seeing one guy when I left gave me a really weird stare, and it turned out to be a DEA agent who knew who I was. But I wasn't connected to the case. I just happened to be there. I think he freaked that I saw him and I would recognize him and tell somebody. But I didn't recognize him at the time. I just couldn't figure out who he was. Then I figured out later on.
Yeah. Here's what happens with policemen, and I've seen myself do this, is you see a lawyer, you're not really, you know, after I became a lawyer, I now understand the relationship, but you don't really know the relationship, whether you're an agent or a policeman, whatever, you don't really understand the relationship between lawyers and clients.
No.
And so you just keep wanting to go down that path that, oh, they must be part of it, they must be part of it, they must be part of it. How could they not be part of it? And it's hard to explain. I can't explain it to my friends. They just look at me like I'm an idiot or something if I try to explain it. That you're not part of it. You're their lawyer. There's a difference.
Now, you know, back in the 80s, the lawyers were the targets. Subpoenas for fees, and, you know, like, we were the bad guys.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous in the 80s. It really was. The lawyers were all the targets. I mean, some of them were doing some shitty things. Some of them were involved. I know lawyers were involved with their clients. Give their clients 50 grand to get 100 back. I mean, now you're not a lawyer anymore. You just lost the lawyer. There is a line you cannot cross. And I can tell you one thing. I have met some of the top dogs in the Chicago outfit that people will never know or never suspect. I have never had heard one guy say one thing about anything inappropriate in front of me.
Yeah.
Ever. Never discussed a damn thing in front of me. I've been out to dinner with many guys. I've been to picnics with people. I've been to weddings. I've sat at tables. Our clients don't tell us their business.
No. They're not idiots.
It's not my business. I remember one time Eddie Jensen told me a story years ago when they killed Willie Dauber. There was allegations that they found out that Dauber was going to court because one of the outfit guys happened to be in Eddie's office and saw the diary and saw the day of court, the day the guy got killed. So there was a lot of hard feelings about what had happened.
Yeah.
And Eddie made a beef. He made a beef to the clients about it. And I'll never forget, he told me Butchie Petroselli came to his office and said, Eddie, you are never to ask a question again, ever. It's none of your fucking business. And you know what? But she was right. Yeah. None of our business. Our clients, whatever they do, when they come around us, they don't tell us their secrets. We don't know what they're doing. I don't ask them, hey, what about this? What about this? Inappropriate. It's inappropriate. You don't do that. When people say, well, they could be part of it, well, really, maybe on the outside because we're down at Rush Street eating and having drinks and laughing and giggling, it might look that way. But in reality, their clients, their friends, and we're not talking about any of that. We never talk about cases, ever, you know, unless we're in the office.
All right, Joe, this has been great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Bye. Well, that was Joseph the Shark Lopez, and a lot of you mob fans from Chicago will know about him. He comments quite often on the different Chicago outfit Facebook interest pages, and he was a really interesting interview. I'm going to get him back on. We talked. He was he represented Frank Calabrese Sr. in the Family Secrets trial, so I was not really prepared. Need to brush up on that Family Secrets case, and then we'll get him back on. He agreed he'd come back on and do that. So I'm glad I was able to get in touch with him and get him to spare me some time, because you know how these real active lawyers are. They can barely squeeze out 5 minutes between running from one court to the other. Joe, I appreciate it. Oh, I looked him up on Chicago PD, on that show, Chicago PD. He is a technical advisor, and he was in a few episodes, he told me, and it was in the third season. It was about the fifth or the sixth when he played a lawyer. He didn't have a very big part right then. I think he had a female client. I don't even remember what the story was now, but so if you're familiar with Chicago PD, you'll be able to see the shark in there. And remember, if you're a veteran and you believe you have problems that might be from PTSD connected to your service time, call your local vet center or the local VA hospital, or they have a national hotline, 1-800-273-8255, and press 1 if you are a vet. You can also go to their website, www.ptsd.va.gov. This site contains a lot of resources. Also, I have the donation button on my shop page. I also have my two movies up for rent for $1.99, Brothers Against Brothers and Gangland Wire. I have my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. So that's about all I got to sell, and that's about all I got. So I look forward to getting Joe Lopez back on, and we're kind of pulling out of this COVID thing. I recorded this kind of early on in it, and I'm finally getting around to editing it and getting it put up. So stay well out there. Good evening, folks. Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.